Hello everyone, this is the second podcast of No More Lethal Waits, 10 Steps to Transform Your Emergency Department. Close the waiting room. Welcome back everyone. Again, that's a theme song from Mission Impossible. And I found the quote that I mentioned in podcast number one. Have a listen.
I don't think I can get her to do it.
You mean it'll be difficult?
Very.
Well, this is not mission difficult, Mr. Hunt. It's mission impossible. Difficult should be a walk in the park for you.
Isn't that awesome? I hope you enjoy that as much as I do. Welcome back to the second podcast. We're looking at the step number two in my book, No More Lethal Waits, 10 Steps to Transform Canada's Emergency Departments. And thank you for coming back. And for those of you who are listening to the first time, this book applies to wherever patients wait, not just in the emergency department, but anywhere that they present and have to wait for care. We're going to be tackling our waiting room and our triage bottleneck today. No matter how much time you spend using Toyota's lean process improvement to make your triage as quick and efficient as possible, if you send your patients back into the waiting room, you're not adding value for them. Triage acts like a dam, like a giant hydroelectric dam that keeps patients out of the main department and creates a giant reservoir out of the waiting room. So the waiting room becomes like a huge, one of those huge water reservoirs, and the triage dam then allows patients to trickle into the department just one or two at a time when we are good and ready to see them. Eli Goldratt called these giant dams, he called them bottlenecks, and he popularized the term in 1984 with his well-known business book. Triage is a giant bottleneck in pretty much every emergency department. There are many other bottlenecks that form and can change and move around during the day. If we have sick calls, we might have staff shortages being a major bottleneck early in the day, and that bottleneck might change to something else later in the day. A bottleneck is something that every patient needs to go through, or every widget in a production line needs to go through, and the bottleneck only has a maximum speed. And the bottleneck's maximum speed is such that it impacts the total speed of the whole production line. So everything has to wait in line before it goes through a particular bottleneck. Now, the trouble with bottlenecks is that not only are they sometimes hard to find, but they can be very challenging to deal with. And the best way to approach a bottleneck is to either unblock it if possible, remove it ideally, improve its speed, and that's what we do with lean processing, or the best approach I think to dealing with a bottleneck is to put it into parallel. So instead of having process steps run in a long line like a freight train where one step has to follow another step, try to put each of your process steps in parallel on their own individual tracks so that they can all race forward at the same time. And this is actually exactly what we do in a trauma case or a major resuscitation. We don't say, okay, you go in and assess the patient and then I'll come in and do my blood work. No, we all descend on the patient, and whoever can get blood or intubate the patient or do an ultrasound or whatever needs to be done, we all do what patients need at the same time. Bottlenecks in the emerge are interesting too. You know, doctors and nurses will have their favorite bottlenecks that they like to complain about, whether it's a slow group of docs or a slow group of nurses or too many admitted patients. We tend to find bottlenecks that we can't control that are outside of our department. So we have to be on the watch for this. The bottlenecks that are outside our department really don't have as much meaning as the ones that we can tackle inside. And so if we look at triage as our classic bottleneck, a step where all patients need to go through. We need to trim it down as much as we can, like we talked about in the first podcast, where triage becomes classic or historical triage, which is focused on sorting patients based on their chief complaint, a quick CTAS score, and then sending them off to where they're going to actually get their care. But after that step, everything else should flow in parallel. So if a secondary nurse is not ready to see the patient and a doctor is, then a doctor should see them, or vice versa. And practically, the way this happens is if you're triaging patients into the department instead of out to the waiting room, you bring the patients all in right into the areas where the docs and nurses are working. So if patients can sit in a chair out in the waiting room, then they can certainly sit in a chair inside in the areas where docs and patients, or docs and nurses rather, provide care. That way, the staff can see immediately whether, you know, 5 or 10 more people just came in quickly. They get a sense immediately of the pressure and the volumes that are on the department. And it encourages that parallel processing of where whoever is available and can get to the chart and the patient, they just go at it and do your thing. It requires flexibility on for docs and nurses, especially if docs are really insistent on having a long secondary nursing assessment before they see patients. But it's the way we treat our most privileged patients. So doctors and nurses who work in the department never tolerate a rigid sequential process. They go in and get what they need, and they'll stand in the hallway if they have to, outside of the subacute area or the acute area. They're not going to stand forever in the waiting room waiting to be dribbled in through the triage bottleneck and when an exam room becomes available. So this change of process raises a whole bunch of challenges with nurse-to-patient ratios and physician scheduling and on-call and the kind of furniture you use, and we're going to be unpacking this in the next few steps. Some of the objections that get raised right up front when you start talking about providing this kind of great access and great service for patients, people have a couple of different questions. They'll say, oh my goodness, this kind of service is just going to attract more volume. All of a sudden, we're going to have everybody coming in because we're providing better access than some of the other clinics in the community, or the walk-in clinics or doc's offices or whatever. I find it bizarre that we use we say, because we're providing so good service, therefore we shouldn't change because our volumes might grow. We're actually going to do such a good job that we're going to get more patients, and so therefore we shouldn't think about doing a good job. The logic just doesn't seem to flow for me. I think if we're doing what's good for patients and volumes increase, so be it. We'll deal with them, and hopefully others will improve along with us. But that in itself is actually a really bad reason not to improve, because being great is going to attract more people to us. That just seems a bizarre reason to not get better. But a little more sophisticated reason people will bring up is they'll say, oh, great, great service will increase our volumes. We're going to have high volumes, and high volumes will cost more. And another complaint people say is, well, a lot of these people that come shouldn't even be in the eMERGE anyways. They should be somewhere else. We should just educate them to go somewhere else. Or another issue people bring up is they say, you know, really, we should only be seeing the sickest people. Emerges should be for emergency cases. We should only see high acuity patients. So how do you answer these questions? So let's deal with the issue about the objection of educating people to go somewhere else. You know, if people would only know better than to come to the eMERGE for such minor issues, we wouldn't have a volume or flow problem in the first place. I deal with this in more depth in the following chapters. I'll just say here that people don't come to the emergency department because they're stupid. They come to the emergency department because they need access to care. And if we want them to go somewhere else, then we need to give them a great alternative to go to. And if we allow this attitude of berating patients almost, like we it becomes toxic, where we say, oh, this person shouldn't even have been in the eMERGE. Why didn't they go somewhere else? that attitude undermines the generosity, the magnanimity, if you will, required for emergency care workers, frontline care workers, to go out and beyond themselves to help people out in distress. If we allow that attitude of, oh, this isn't even a real eMERGE complaint, why didn't they go somewhere else? If we allow that attitude to seep into what we're trying to build in our department, we won't build the kind of service model that we want. But we're going to talk a lot more about that in subsequent chapters, subsequent podcasts. Well, what do we say about the idea of high volume versus high acuity? So one way to answer that is to consider our highest acuity patients. So if you can picture someone who's not breathing, they're coding, they've arrested, or a major trauma case, we've all seen the crowds that descend around one patient. You know, the room is packed. Sometimes there's 10 people in the room, and people, you know, providers will get frustrated with that. They'll say, get out of the room. I need space to work. But just for argument's sake, let's say we have a patient who's arresting and they need to be intubated. We need at least one doc in there, often one or two docs. Now, granted, sometimes the RT will get in there and intubate before the doc even arrives. But ultimately, we're going to need at least one physician and often two. These kind of patients generally require two or three or even more nurses. They often require an RT, a clerk. And so I think to come up with a conservative number, these acutely ill people, the sickest of the sick, require at least four staff around them, starting lines, intubating, giving meds, charting, doing x-rays, all the stuff that needs to happen, drawing bloods, etc. Now, we all see sick people like this, those of us who are in eMERGEs, especially in high acuity eMERGEs or high volume eMERGEs, we'll see I slipped up there where I said high acuity eMERGEs, and what I meant to say is high volume eMERGEs. We'll all see sick patients like this every day, and we all have seen two really sick patients like this at the same time. And in fact, in a big eMERGE, you might see patients clustering like this every couple days, or certainly every a few times during the week. And in a large eMERGE, we've all seen where three patients tank in quick succession or all at once. You know, an ambulance brings one in that's really, really sick, and the team's already working on someone else, and someone else, another patient in your eMERGE is requiring intubation at the same time. And if we take it one last step, I think most of us have heard of a time when even four patients were crashing at the same time or in quick succession. Now, granted, those happen rarely, at least in, eMERGEs up to 100,000 visits. But the three crashing patients will happen every few months or so, at least in the places that I have experience with. So if we take a conservative number of four staff per really sick patient, we need upwards of 16 staff standing by at the ready to deal with these kind of clusters of emergencies, that clusters of high acuity emergencies that come in from our community. Now, granted, there are a lot of other really sick people that require care, to CTAS 2 and CTAS 3 patients. And so those 16 people could be caring for some of those. But still, over 50% of the patients that we're seeing aren't those super, super sick patients. And so it seems like it would be an incredible waste to have that resource ready and standing by so that we can deal with the rare times when we need all hands on deck, all 16. And notwithstanding, sometimes you can often call anesthesia or other services to come and help you. But ultimately, the responsibility rests on the emergency department. And again, we're just building an argument to respond to this high acuity accusation. So it would be incredibly inefficient. And in fact, hospitals have had to deal with this exact issue in the operating room. Many hospitals will have a trauma room. If they're providing trauma services, they'll have a trauma suite staffed and ready to deal with trauma surgeries. And how do hospitals improve efficiency of having this really expensive resource all set up and ready to go on standby if it's not being used? How do they improve the efficiency of that service? Well, they improve it by getting the trauma teams and the trauma rooms working on less urgent cases in between trauma cases. And so we can use the same analogy for emergency departments. It would be an incredible waste to have this massive acute care service only seeing these mythical high acuity only patients if there was some possible way to filter them all out. It would be incredibly, incredibly inefficient. But the other criticism that people often raise is, you know, well, why couldn't we just send all these patients to a clinic? You know, come on, they just have even the acute abdominal pains or chest pains. They could be all seen in an outpatient clinic. And I suppose if we had an outpatient clinic that had physicians trained to deal with this kind of acute care, and we had stat labs and acute or urgent access to ultrasounds and CAT scanning, and we had IV bags and tubing and you know, acute care medications and nurses ready to give it and trained to give it, and possibly a crash cart ready for the people that go south. Yeah, well, you know, we could do that. But that's starting to sound an awful lot like an eMERGE. And so an eMERGE by any other name is still an eMERGE. And the argument to say that why don't we just send them to a clinic, it just doesn't seem to hold for me either. But finally, when you think about efficiency, how much we're spending per patient case in the emergency department, higher volume or eMERGEs that welcome all comers and fit in the lower acuity cases in between the higher acuity work that they're doing, and eMERGEs that are able to do that and provide a great level of service with low wait times turn out to be very efficient. They have the lowest costs per case. And hospital boards are more sophisticated now in the last 15 years or so than they were perhaps 25, 30 years ago. The hospital boards are full of people who have financial wisdom and experience that I don't think was always there on all boards in decades ago. And so when they see a department that has, okay, it has high volumes, but wow, are they ever efficient? They have the lowest cost per case around, and yet they still have an admit rate similar to other people in their region. Hospital boards are impressed with that, and they won't look as favorably on a department who pursues this dream of or this mythical ideal of a high acuity only eMERGE, because that eMERGE, yeah, sure, they'll have lower volumes, but their costs per case are going to be through the roof, and I would argue that they actually don't cost much less in the end anyways, because the fixed costs of maintaining and staffing an emergency department are so substantial in and of themselves. And so the lower acuity volumes that tend to come in when you provide great service are actually being served on the marginal costs that are quite small compared to the fixed costs of maintaining your emergency department and keeping it open. So I think it's most important that we put patient needs first, that we treat our patients like privileged patients, and try to give them the same service and care that we give to the more savvy and privileged customers that are patients that come into our departments. So that's it for this podcast number 2. The next one we tackle redefining nurse-patient ratios. As you can imagine, if you bring the whole waiting room into the department, now we're going to kind of blow up nurse-patient ratios. And how do we deal with that? How do we get more docs on board when we need them? And those are the sorts of things we'll be tackling in the next podcast. I really appreciate the questions that have been raised and comments so far. Please take some time to talk to your friends and colleagues about these issues. I think that one of the strongest ways we can promote change is by spreading great ideas and trying creative new things and just encouraging each other to be brave and take risks and push the envelope a wee bit. So thanks so much for your time. I appreciate you listening to these podcasts. Please let me know how we can improve on the content, and be sure to share your questions and arguments, and I'll try to get to them in the future. Bye for now. We'll see you on the next one.